Welcome. I'm glad everyone found their way here. Of course, anyone who didn't find their way here isn't here, so I hope they're okay wherever they are. We are at the very end of Perek Yitzayin, chapter 17, page 983, if you are using the stone of Tanakh. And really the focus today is going to be on chapter 18. And you look at it and think, wow, that's a really small chapter. You could probably do that one easy. And whoa, is that not true? There's so much going on here. But first of all, just recap chapter 17. Remember that we're in this section of Yeshaya in which he is addressing the foes of the Jews. 10 different prophecies towards the enemies of the Jews from the region. And as we've said, Yeshaya isn't traveling to them to speak to them. He's not going to Moab to talk to the Moabites. He's talking to the Jews. And the lessons that he's giving are really lessons for us about what Hashem is going to do, about the unreliability of alliances made with these various nations. He started with Babylon, went to the Plishtim, the Philistines, went to Moab. And then in chapter 17, we learned about his address to the Syro-Ephraimite alliance, Aram, also known as Damascus, also known as Syria, and Israel, the northern kingdom. And that was our focus last time. We talked about the punishment coming to Ephraim in agricultural imagery, where he talks about poverty and hunger and with it the image, the associated image of exile. We noted within there that the righteous will repent when they see what happens to the northern kingdom. But overall, it's an image of agricultural destruction and with it, the point of reversion to the state of Canaan. And the idea is the land is going to revert to what it was like under Canaan because you reverted to be like Canaan. Something that is a much bigger theme in Tanakh. We talked about how with King Ahab you find that theme, the rebuilding of Jericho, of Jericho. So the northern kingdom is going to be punished, and then the latter part of the chapter, the last part of the chapter, really, the Assyrians are going to be punished as well. The Assyrians who came in to punish the northern kingdom, to punish Aram, they themselves are going to suffer. Those were the last couple of psukim. And that was sentences 12, 13, and 14. We have this very powerful image that we concluded with from sentence 14, where he said, "La'et erev vihine valaha." At the time of evening, there will be balaha. Balaha, they rendered here as fright, which is a legitimate translation. Sometimes it's associated with demons, and that's a more fun translation. But what we said was that la'et erev, at the time of erev, there will be fright for the enemy and hope for us. And we noted that the phrase la'et erev shows up four times in Tanakh. Each time it's a time of darkness, a time of uncertainty, but also a time of hope and landmark change. The first time was on the boat, on Davach's boat, when the Yonah, the dove, comes back at last with the olive leaf. And then when Eliezer davens at the well, he doesn't know what's going to be the future of Abraham's family. Will he find a wife for Yitzchak or not? It's here, which is when Sanherib attacks Jerusalem. And then finally, in Zechariah, the last chapter of Zechariah, regarding the time of Gog and Magog and Mashiach. So I had one last source that I wanted to bring regarding this chapter, in source number one. In source number one, we're 3 minutes in already, arousing a round of applause. This is a medrash on the term Mayim Rabim. Mayim Rabim shows up in our vision here when we said, where was it? In sentence 13, Le'umim Kishaon Mayim Rabim. Nations like the roar of great waters, Yishaon, they will roar like that. So take a look at this medrash. Mayim Rabim Elu Ha'ovde Kochavim. Great waters refers to the idolaters. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, Kahamot Yamim Yehemayun. They roar like the seas. ואם היו מתכנסים כל העובדי כוכבים לבטל את האהבה שבין הקדוש ברוך הוא לישראל, לא היו יכולים. But no matter how much they roar, no matter what they try to do, they cannot get rid of the love between God and the Jews. And so we associate it with another pasuk with Mayim Rabim, and this is in Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs. Mayim Rabim lo yuchlu lechabot et ha'ahava. Great water could not extinguish the love. So the idea is that the association of Mayim Rabim in Yeshaya with Mayim Rabim in Shir HaShirim is to say that these great waters of the nations are not simply waters that want to flood us, but they want to eliminate our relationship with God, but they won't succeed. That's the promise of Shir HaShirim. Of course, we have other Mayim Rabim in Tanakh, Mikolot Mayim Rabim in Tehillim, in Psalms. We can find other ones. I just like that message at the close of what is a very frightening chapter. Well, chapter 18 is not frightening. Chapter 18 is confusing. How many people here looked at it ahead of time? Don't be afraid to say yes or no. Okay, so we have about half the group saw it ahead of time, half the group did not. So we're going to read it through, and that way we will all have the same level of confusion. So again, page 983. You are welcome to read it in the Hebrew. You are welcome to read it in the English. It's not going to help reading it in the English. It's not going to change anything. Yeah?
This Hebrew seemed harder to me when I read it in the Hebrew than some of the other Hebrew.
There are a couple of words in this chapter which really defy translation. One of them is this phrase in the beginning, "Sealed Sal Knafayim," is a hard one. There was another word in here, right? Hazal Zalim, which we get to towards the end of the chapter, is another one. So you do find some tough words. It's also less poetic in its flow. You don't have the same couplet type of a format that you're familiar with from elsewhere, so that can make it a harder read. As we noted from Ibn Ezra last time, when you read Yeshaya, when you read Yirmiyahu, when you have these couplet forms, you can use what you see in one half to explain what's in the other half. Okay, so let's take a look. Hoy Eretz Tzil Tzal Kinafayim, right? Yeshaya likes the word hoy. Hoy is often an exclamation of woe, or it's just a general exclamation. Hoy Eretz Tzil Tzal Kinafayim. They take it here as the land of clamorous wings. Tzil Tzal, right? Like Letzal Tzel, to ring, right? So it's the ringing of the wings. Maybe. Asher Me'ever L'Nahare Kush, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. Looked on Google Maps. There are some rivers, but I couldn't tell which rivers it was. They didn't say. The Usha'on Le'umim Kisha'on Mayim Kabirim Yishaun. And once, I'm sorry, I just jumped back. I jumped back to a previous line. Never mind. Hashaleach Bayam Tzirim. Who sends Tzirim? Tzirim are, well, if you read it, you know. Right, messengers, basically, right? Messengers. He sends messengers upon the sea. He being, we assume, the Ethiopians. Or whoever it is who's beyond Ethiopia. You who send messengers upon the sea. Uvechle gome al pnei mayim, in reed boats upon the water. Lechu malachim kalim, you who send these messengers, go forth, swift agents. El goy mimushach umorat, and that is a hard one to translate. To a nation that is mimushach, mimushach can mean extended, can mean drawn along, and morat can mean two opposite things. Morat can mean to be plucked, like people pulled out their hair. Or morat can mean that which is flashy, it shines in the sun. So two very different meanings, and we'll see both apply here. But whoever it is, the Ethiopians, we think, or whoever's beyond Ethiopia, is supposed to send messengers to this nation, El Am Nora, Minhu Vahala, to a nation which is described as being Nora. Nora is another word that can have very different meanings. Right? When a person in Israel today says Nora, what do they mean?
Awful.
Awful, but awful can also have two meanings. Right. Awful, literally, etymologically, awful is something that inspires awe. However, awful colloquially is terrible. And terrible is another word that has two different meanings. Miserable, horrible.
Well,
awful isn't awesome is the right word for the other meaning, not awful.
But not originally. Awful meant.
I wasn't there originally.
Well, I was.
I'm
feeling my age today. Sorry. Here it says terrible, but terrible is the same thing. Inspires terror or miserable, for lack of a better term, that will be more clearly expressive of the negative. So, am nora, to a nation that is nora, in one of the meanings of nora, minhu vahala, from there and beyond. Goy kav umuvusa, that's another one. Kav is a line, a boundary, but kav can also be an expression of tikva, of hope. And either way, I wouldn't know how to translate that phrase. Mivusa is the one that I can do a little better with. Mivusa generally is something that is destroyed, that is trampled. Asher bazu naharim artzo, whose land was destroyed or despoiled by rivers. So you're going to a nation which is either awe-inspiring or awful, right, with some kind of message. Kol yoshvei sevel v'shochnei aretz. Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3. We're still on page 983. All who dwell in Tevel. Sorry.
It says kings, not rivers.
Right, because I have to come back to that. There are different ways to translate the word Naharim. They're taking it one way. Kol yoshvei sevel. All who dwell in civilization, in settled land, v'shochnei aretz. Those who reside in the land. Kinesones harim tiru. When the nace is a pole, used as a miracle sometimes, it's a banner. When the miracle or the banner is raised on the mountains, you will see, v'chizkoa shofar tishmo, as the shofar blows, then you will hear. And of course, we use that pasuk where? In our liturgy? Right, Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Kinesones harim tiru v'chizkoa shofar tishmau. It's associated with the time of Mashiach there. So far, I have a message being sent. I'm not really sure who is sending it. Somebody in Ethiopia or beyond. I'm not sure to whom they're sending it. Somebody who's really suffering or somebody who's awe-inspiring. And all the dwellers of the land are going to see something and hear something. Okay, good. Now that we don't understand that, let's see the rest of the chapter. Kicho amar Hashem Eli, because this is what God said to me. Yeshaya is the speaker. Yeshaya says, God said the following to me. Eshkata ve'abita b'mechoni. I'm going to settle down. I'm going to look at my foundation. Kechom tzach ale or. Like pure heat upon or. Or can be light. Most commentators here are going to render it as rain. We'll see more about that.
Is God speaking to
Yeshaya? Yes. Ka'av tal bechom katsir. Like a cloud associated with dew at the heat of the harvest. Those are positive images. Right? The image of the heat after the rain, or maybe with light, we'll see. The image of the dew at the time of the harvest. Ki lifnei katsir. Kesam perach, because before the harvest, at the end of the flowering, uvoser gomel yehien nitsa. Boser is a term that we usually use for underripe fruit. So when the flower is done, and as they translate here, you now have the beginnings of the fruit. V'charas hazal zalim b'mazmeros. He will cut off the branches using pruning hooks. And the twigs, as they translate netishot here, which is as good a translation as I've seen, he removes those. So at the time of the harvest, God's cutting off branches, which is usually not something you do, of course. The branches that were cut off are going to be left for the ayat. An ayat is generally some kind of bird of prey or of, what's the other one? Not prey, carrion. This bird of the mountains is going to be the one who's going to take these branches, as well as behemat ha'aretz, the beasts of the land. V'katz alav ha'ayit v'chol behemat ha'aretz alav teche raf. And the bird of prey will cuts on it, cuts to be disgusted or cuts to complete it, and the beasts of the land will techeraf, which could mean to attack harshly, but of course you see the association, and I see the art scroll picked it up, kayitz choref. They'll eat it in the summer, they'll eat it in the winter. Last sentence in this parak. Ba'esahi, in that time, yuval shay lashem tzvakot, a gift will be brought for God. Am memushach umorat, that nation we described before that is drawn along or extended, that is morat. Either their sword flashes, the blade flashes, or they are plucked. Umeam nora, from this nation that is nora, awe-inspiring or miserable. Minhu vahala, from there and beyond. In other words, the language that we used in sentences 2 and 3. Goy kav kav umuvusa, and whatever that meant in sentence 2 is what it means here, bless you. Asher bazu naharim arzo, whose land was despoiled by rivers or kings. El mikom shem Hashem tzvakot har tzion, to the mountain of Tzion, the place of God. Now that we know that, we can just go on to chapter 19. I spent so much time trying to understand this. Like, what in the world is going on here? You read it, and first of all, when is this even happening? I don't know. Is it one vision? Is it multiple visions? What does this have to do with the previous chapter? Right? You went from Syria and the Northern Kingdom to talk about Ethiopia, with a little digression into the upheaval of the Assyrians. How did one lead to two? Where did that go?
Is it in the right place? Is it written by the same place?
Yeah, I look at it and think, I know you were here, and I think you're here now, Ethiopia, right? And I don't understand how you got from point A to point B, and certainly for someone like me, as we've already discussed, I believe in one author. So I'm really lost. It would be a lot easier to just say, yeah, I got dropped in here. It actually belongs in Yechezkel. No. Yeah, sorry, Paul.
No, it just seems to me that previously we had been talking about the other nations being told that what has happened to the Jewish people, that their relationship with the Jewish people led to, God's relationship with the Jewish people led to destruction, but it was a warning to them too. That they would suffer the of having to destroy the Jewish people or to disperse the Jewish people.
Yeah.
So isn't this a continuation of that theme, only farther away?
Meaning?
Meaning that instead of telling Babylon this, you're telling Cush.
Right. So now we're going out to
Ethiopia. It's going out to the world. In fact, it's a way of saying the world, that the Jewish people are being punished by God through them, or through a nation, but that that nation is not God's, anything but God's instrument, and that God wants them to know that their turn will come too.
And as a result, gifts will be brought to God at the end of the chapter?
Meaning that the whole world will recognize that it was God's doing.
Well, that's a terrible way to bring Mashiach, isn't it?
Well, no.
I don't want that.
No.
So the commentators take it a little differently. They're with you in terms of broadcasting something to the nations, but not that. This is really, really hard, and what makes it even harder, and this goes back to Susan's point, is the language is so difficult. The land of wings, sender of boats, the nation that is, you know, extended, plucked, drawn along, flashy, like what in the world is this about? So, if you look at your sheet, at source number 2, I gave you a very fast summary of 4 approaches to this chapter, and what I want to do is outline the 4 overall approaches and then unpack the different reads to it. So, your first view that I'm bringing here is not, I'm not doing it in the order, the chronological order of the commentators. I'm doing it based on the chronological order of predictions, meaning there are different views about when this happens, so I'm starting with the earliest view of when this takes place, and then working our way later in history. So the first view is the view that this is actually a message to the Assyrians. Malbim presents this view. And the message is, you think you're going to conquer the Jews. And you think that everybody has to bow to you. God is going to let you think that for a while. But he's going to stop you when you attack Jerusalem. When you attack the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, that's where God holds you short. At that point, God is going to cut off the corruption that began among the Jews, and you, the Assyrians, you're going to bring the Jews home. You, the Assyrians, you're going to bring the Jews home. And the way that Malbim reads it is that it's an extension of chapter 17. Meaning, the end of chapter 17 talks about the downfall of the Assyrians. And so chapter 18 is going to be more of the same. You know, Assyrians, you're going to overplay your hand. You're going to attack Jerusalem, and at that point it's all over for you. You're going to bring the Jews back. Now, this fits into the way the Malbim read chapter 17, and you'll recall that when we read chapter 17 last week, I said I'm not really going into Malbim much because he has a radically different read of that chapter. I stand my ground. I'm not going back to reread chapter 17 with Malbim, but you should understand he had a little bit of a different, or a lot bit of a different take on the chapter in general. But the point for us still stands, which is, according to Malbim, and again, we're going to read Malbim himself, but I want to go through the four views first. But according to Malbim, this is a prediction for the time of Chizkiyahu. The Assyrians are going to fall when they invade Jerusalem, and ultimately, they're going to bring the Jews home. That's view number one.
He's translating Cush, not Ethiopia, but...
We'll see. It's a good question. Alright, so I'll tell you. The way Malbim reads... No, because it's not fair. The way Malbim reads it is that that land is actually Assyria, which I assume means under the control of the Assyrians. In other words, look at a map. You can tell. There's no way that beyond the rivers of Ethiopia is Assyria. You're on the wrong continent. But what he means is land controlled by the Assyrians, that that's how far their conquest spreads. Okay. Second view is that it's a message also about the fall of Assyria, but later in history. And this is Ibn Ezra's approach. And the message is telling the Assyrians, send messengers to the Jews who are exiled to Ethiopia, letting them know that Sanherib, the Assyrian general, the Assyrian king, has been defeated. Okay, send messages to the Jews who have been exiled to Ethiopia, letting them know that Sanherib has been defeated. The idea that Jews are exiled by the Assyrians beyond a river appears in various psukim. In the interest of time, we're not going to look them up, but in number 3, I showed you various references that speak to the Jews being exiled past a river. And why is this message here? Because it continues to speak about what happened with Assyria. Again, the end of the last chapter was about the Assyrians, so now we continue in that frame of mind. So the first one is it's a message to the Assyrians. Send the Jews home. When you try to attack Jerusalem. The second is that it's a message about the fall of Assyria, saying to the Assyrians, send messengers, let those Jews know it's time for them to come home. The exiled 10 tribes. Then you move forward in history. The third view is Radak. And Radak says it's a message about the arrival of Mashiach. And what it's doing is it's telling the king of the land beyond Ethiopia, who is not Assyria, the king of the land beyond Ethiopia, to send messengers to the Jews who are beyond the sea, across the sea, with gifts to bring them back home. And in the future, all lands are going to do this. And the reason this is here is because we just spoke about a miraculous salvation from the Assyrians at the end of chapter 17. So now we talk about another great salvation, the future one in the time of Mashiach. The view that this is about Mashiach's time is consistent with the Gemara in Sanhedrin, where this passage is quoted to refer to the time of Mashiach, and as I noted before, the way this line is used in the liturgy on Rosh Hashanah, the line of Kol Yoshvei Tevel, sentence 3, Kol Yoshvei Tevel v'shoch ne'eret k'nesonei sarim tiru, that line is used in the Rosh Hashanah davening to refer to a time of Mashiach that's consistent with this read. So it's about Mashiach's arrival. Yeah.
Do non-Jews use this as proof of Messiah?
I don't see how they would, but it's never impossible to think they might. I mean, meaning, this is a clear idea of a redemption.
Don't the non-Jews and Christians use this to prove that Jesus is the Messiah or something?
I don't see how they would, they do, and we've talked about some of the chapters where they do. I'm just not familiar with the use of this chapter in this way.
Okay.
Yeah, but there is a lot of Isaiah. We saw it in the earlier going. We saw cases of it. It's possible they do it with this. I'm just not familiar. And then the last view is Abarbanel. And Abarbanel is similar to the idea that it's about Mashiach, but he goes one step beyond. He says it's not just about Mashiach, it's about Tchiyat HaMeitim, the ultimate restoration of the dead to life. And he says the message is to the nations who had once been under the Assyrians, because he says the defeat of Sanherib is such a big deal that in the future, when people see the time of Mashiach, they're going to say, oh, that's like what God did to Sanherib. Now, honestly, I think if I polled, 1,000 people who weren't Jewish on the streets in Toronto, I don't know that any of them would have any clue what I was talking about with Sanherib and the Assyrians. Maybe in lands that had been under the Assyrians, they remember them a little bit more. You'd have to take a class trip, and we can go and find out what they're thinking in Iran and Iraq and ask them that question. But Abarbanel says that they're going to remember that story. And that's why this is here. And the message will be, send boats at that time, the time of Mashiach, to bring the Jews home. And all the nations are going to do this to make peace with us at that point. So, four different takes. One view is a message to the Assyrians saying, God's going to cut you off and you're going to bring the Jews home. Second view, message to the Assyrians, go send messengers to the Jews, telling them it's time to come home. Third view is about Mashiach's arrival, telling the king of the land beyond Ethiopia to send messengers to the Jews who are beyond the sea to come home. And the only relationship with Assyria is, there was a redemption and here's a redemption. And then the last view is that it's about Mashiach plus Tchiyat HaMeitim, the resurrection of the dead, and the idea that the nations who had lived under the Assyrians are now going to send boats to bring the Jews home in the time of Mashiach. Those are our four views. We're going to take them slower now, one by one, and hopefully that will help. You see that I didn't translate it on the sheet. I noted in my email I was just way out of time to be able to do it, but it's okay. We're going to read through it. And from my standpoint, the most important part of the source sheet is really number two, where I gave you that list, because that's your focal point. You remember it? Now we're just going to see how it fits into the verses, Paul.
Isn't Arvanel's interpretation, doesn't it imply that the Empire of Assyria is going to last until Mashiach?
No, what he's saying, what Abarbanel is saying is that in the future, they will remember what happened to the Assyrians when they attacked Jerusalem. Even though the Assyrians are ancient history. That's what he's saying. You'll see it. We're going to read it inside. We'll see. Yes.
So what does he base the coming of Mashiach on, that the Jews have now become Shomrei Mitzvot, or they've given up idols? Like, he must think.
Good. So let's come to that. It's a good question. We'll see it as we read through each one. Let's talk Malbim first. Okay? So looking at source number four. Hoy, right? Hoy being woe, or being just a proclamation, a declaration. Atam efaresh hamashal mihem hamona mimrabim. He says, here's the explanation of the end of chapter 17, where it talks about the noise of many nations. Omer hu eret hachama asher me'eber narei Kush, that is the land of the sun, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. Shehu eret Ashur, which is the land of Assyria. And again, I can't think he means it's Assyria. The Malbim has a globe. He means land that was controlled by the Assyrians. So he says, Hasholeach, the one who sends messengers, who shalach shluchim al Yisrael. He, this is in the past, sent messengers to Israel, which is true. The Assyrians sent messengers saying, surrender. Lechu, you should go, swift messengers. Elad b'rimasher sam b'fiat zirim shiramru liYisrael. This is what he's saying the messengers should say to Israel. Shira katuv, and the way to read the sentence is, Atem goy kav lakav mevusa lechu malachim kalim agoyim mushachu morat, meaning, hatzirim yomru lahem. The messengers on these boats are going to say to the Jews, you, Israel, you are the nation who divided up his land, Bikav, with a line, Ubasasu nachlatchem, and your portion was destroyed. Asher bazu naharim artzachem, rivers, I'm taking it as rivers right now, despoiled your land. You committed crimes that resulted in the enemy ravaging your land. Ein lachem eitza lehi maleh. You have no way to escape. The only thing you can do is go swiftly to the Assyrians. Goy memushach umorat, a nation which is memushach umorat in the positive sense. Memushach, they're extended, they have a broad empire. Morat, their sword flashes in the sun. They're an am nora, they're a scary nation. That's the idea. A nation that everybody is afraid of. So the message to the Jews is, you should go to the Assyrians, give yourselves up to the Assyrians, and then, kol yoshvei, all of the nations of the land. And this is now part of what the messengers are telling the Jews. Omrim, they say to the Jews, I'm in I guess technically the third paragraph in number four. Lo levad Yisrael muchrachim lihimaser elav. It's not only the Jews who are going to be given over to the Assyrians. Aval gam kol yoshvei tevel, but everybody on earth, all of civilization, kolchem tiru be'ez yisu neis al harim lavo alechem lemelchama. You will all see the banner raised on the mountain when the Assyrians attack, and then you will hear the trumpet of war. So he's saying to the Assyrians, go send messengers to the Jews. So let the messengers say the Jews should come to you. It's time for them to be exiled among you. And send the messages to the whole world that everybody is going to fall to Assyria. Let the Jews know it's not just you. The whole world is going to fall to them. But then you get the about face. If you see what the exclamation point is in number four. Meshivlo anavi, the prophet responds, Lo kemach shavotecha Ashur, it's not like you think Assyria. That's not what God is thinking. Because God said to me, says Yeshaya, Chila eshkata, I'm going to be quiet at first. I'm going to let you do what you want to do. But abit b'mechoni, I'm going to look at my foundation. I'm going to look at my temple, my Beis HaMikdash, Yerushalayim and the temple. That's where I'm going to look. And when you attack there, at that point, I'm going to cut you off. At that point, I will be like the sun coming out to bring bracha, to bring blessing, and to dry up the flood. I'm going to be like the cloud of dew that gets rid of the dangers of the heat. I'll be a moderating influence. And at that point, the enemy will be cut off and left for the beasts of the field and so on. That's the way Malbim reads it. So Malbim says, the opening message to the Am Memushach Umorat, the opening lesson that's sent is sent to the Jews. Well, it's sent to Assyria to tell the Jews, come to us, and all the nations are going to come to us, but you should know you're going to overextend it. You're going to attack Jerusalem. And when you do, then I'm going to cut you off. The branches is the bait before the harvest. You follow? Are we okay? I mean, I'm going a little quickly with it, but yes? No? Okay. That's Malbim. Ibn Ezra's read is somewhat easier because the Malbim requires a shift of focus. The first part of the chapter is speaking to the Assyrians and encouraging them, and then the second part of the chapter is saying, "Ha ha, fooled you! You're going to attack Jerusalem, and at that point, it's all going to be over for you." So he has this shift of focus between the first half and the second half. Ibn Ezra doesn't do that. He says in number 5 that it's a call to a very broad land beyond Ethiopia. He explains Tzilzel Kenafayim. He says it's like a double shady area because it's a very broad land. That's the way that he takes it. and it's beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. And he says that's under the empire of the Assyrians. And what he reads is the following. You know what I think I'm going to do? Rather than read out the Hebrew and translate it along the way, which I suspect is losing people a little bit, so the non-Hebrew readers, I think what I'm actually going to do is go through the verses as they do it, and do it within the psukim, within the verses, and you can refer to the what I have on the sheet. I think that may work better. So Ibn Ezra says on 983, he doesn't read this clamorous ways. That's not his read. He says it's a call to this broad land beyond Ethiopia, which is under the control of the Assyrians, and he says, you normally send boats on the sea, across the water. Now, I want you to instead send your messengers to the Jews. The Jews who had suffered, and he reads Mimushach u'morat to mean pulled around in different directions. Morat, they are plucked. People pull at them. They so send your message to those Jews, but they are now Am Norah. They're a nation that had miracles done for them, and therefore they're a wondrous nation, a nation that inspires awe. That's the way he's going to read it. They did suffer. They had their land destroyed, but no more. That's the way that Ibn Ezra reads this. And the message to them and to all the nations is, all of you are going to send messengers to the Jews who live among you. Ethiopians, you're going to send it to the people beyond the rivers. All the other nations, you're going to send it to the Jews who live in your midst. By the way, how close is this to what happens with Cyrus and the call to send the Jews home, right? That's what he says. Because he says, God said to me that God is going to settle benevolently in his machon, in Yerushalayim, like warm air after rain, like dew after a harvest. And what he is going to do is he's going to cut off the enemy, Assyria, at the time of the harvest before they can bear fruit. And then he ends the same way that we saw already in Malbim. The Assyrian soldiers will be left for the birds of prey and the beasts to eat the carcasses, and the Jews will be brought back to God as a gift to God. That's Ibn Ezra's read. So the idea is, again, a call to the Ethiopians, to the Ethiopians who are under the Assyrians, to send the Jews home. All are about this historic time, the time of Assyria so far. Yes, really.
Dealt with this. Yeshaya is at the same. Where is Daniel and
Daniel is long after.
This is long after.
No, Yeshaya is long after. Yeshaya is before. Daniel is long after. Yeshaya is approximately 100 to 150 years before. Call it 100 years before the destruction of the first temple. Daniel is between the first and second temple.
This is before the destruction.
Yes, correct. The Assyrians, remember, at this stage, have not invaded yet. They're threatening. Everyone is afraid of them. But the Assyrians have not actually invaded at this stage. Okay. Assuming we read this passage as being where it appears in the book, which does seem like a reasonable read. Then you get Radak. And Radak, remember, shifts us to the future. He's talking not about what is for us the past, the time of the Assyrians. He's talking about the future, a time of Mashiach. And the way that Radak reads it, go back to the beginning of the chapter again, he says it's a call to the land beyond Ethiopia's rivers, and he has this fascinating read of Tzilzal Kenafayim. He says Tzilzal Kenafayim refers to the masts of the boats that they have. The boats have these masts that when they are unfurled, the sails on them are unfurled, they look like wings. He says that's Tzilzal Kenafayim. The land with the wings, it means the lands of the sails on their boats. That's the way he reads it. Or, second approach he offers, that it's a land hidden from people in the shadows. Yes?
Is Kenafayim literally wings, like angels' wings?
It's wings, yeah. Yeah, we talk about it with birds usually. Kanfei Nesharim is one image. There are lots of them, yeah. Yeah.
Isn't there also the idea, and I don't know where it is, but the
the people from Yemen used that when they went up there
right.
as well.
Right.
They're going in the wings of angels.
Eagles.
Yes.
Or vultures.
Because this is the same idea that the exiles are coming back.
Right. So the image there that you're thinking of is from the 19th chapter of Shemot, of Exodus, where God promises that he's going to bring us on the wings of Nisharim, which are often translated as eagles. So yes, there was that idea there. But the image here is actually a land of Kinafayim, a land of wings. And it's the sails on the ship that Radak thinks, or alternatively, a land hidden in shadows from people. That's his alternate explanation of it. It's a land with a lot of rivers surrounded by trees, and therefore it's not exposed. Right? Remember, this is an African image to him. And so Radak says, and keep in mind when Radak lives, right? Radak is I believe, early 13th century, which is a time when you don't have great exploration coming back to Spain to explain what this land looks like. That's going to be different from what we're going to see in Abarbanel, who's very, very funny, as you'll see. So he says, this land of Tzilzal Kinafayim, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, and they normally send out boats to sea, and the message that I want them to bring is about this Goy Memushach Umorat. He takes Memushach Umorat again to mean, like Ibn Ezra does, a land of a nation that has suffered. They've been pulled along, dragged along. They've been plucked. Am Noram Minhu Vahala, a land that now has miracles done on their behalf. I have to correct one mistake I made when I was reading. I apologize. I had jumped in my comments. Am Noram for Ibn Ezra was the Ethiopians. A frightening nation. That was Ibn Ezra. Radak is the one who says a nation that had miracles done for them, referring to the Jews. So it doesn't change the substance of things. I just wanted to make sure to correct the translation. But Radak says, send messengers to those Jews who suffered, whose land was destroyed by the rivers, but now they have had miracles done on their behalf. And he quotes you a passage in Sephaniah. Sephaniah talks about in the future the nation sending gifts to God. And he says that's part of this also, that they're going to send gifts. All of them will do this. All of them will send the Jews home in the time of Mashiach. And then God will settle upon them benevolently, like warm air after a rain, like dew at the time of the harvest. And he says this will be a time of Gog and Magog, the great war associated with the time of Mashiach, and God is going to cut off the enemies in mid-attack as they near completion, like cutting off the branches near the harvest, and they'll be left for the birds and the beasts in the summer and in the winter. He's then bothered by that, because Yechezkel has a prediction that with the war of Gog and Magog, at the end, the Jews are going to go around and bury the bodies. So he says, yeah, but it's going to take time. You didn't just do that in one day. So the beasts and the birds will have their way while the Jews are getting around to doing the burial. That's all. That's the way he takes care of that problem. But it's a side note. And in the end, the nations bring gifts to God. So again, I want to make sure we're not getting too lost here in terms of the key elements of the chapter before we get to Abarbanel, he's just remarkable. There's no other word for it. Abarbanel, we're going to read inside because you can't not. But the idea here is, going back again to Malbim, summoning the people of this land of Tzilzal Kinafayim who are under the Assyrians, and saying to them, it's time for you to send your messengers to bring the Jews home. That's the idea that Malbim sees. He says, the Assyrians think they're going to conquer everybody. They think the message to send to the Jews is, you should capitulate now, just give in, you're going to all be merged into the Assyrian Empire. And my response is, when the Assyrians attack Jerusalem, all of that is over. Susan.
I'm just trying to figure out, okay, the first two are prophecies of what will happen in the near
future. In the near future, correct.
But then Radak comes out with the Mashiach.
You got it.
But we've been just told by Yeshayahu how they're idol worshipping and they're going to be something. And suddenly, they're good. How did they get good from that?
And the answer is, they're not necessarily good. The turning point that Radak sees here is the if you take a look at sentence 4, is when God remembers Jerusalem. When God remembers the Beit HaMikdash, the temple, that's when things turn. It's not because we've been wonderful.
We're always, that's what I was taught, we don't, Mashiach isn't going to come, so we're good people.
We have way too many predictions in order to give one uniform explanation of what it is that's going to be. Meaning, you may have heard at some point the idea that either it'll come when we're all good, or it'll come when we're all bad. You have both options. There is an idea that there's a set time for Mashiach, but if you earn it, it can come early. So yeah, there are lots of other explanations about what it is that triggers, that catalyzes the arrival of Mashiach. But again, the key elements of the chapter, according to Malbim, are the first part is a message to the Assyrians, saying, you think everybody is going to go your way, you're sending messengers, you should all give in now. And God says, when you attack Jerusalem, it's all over. And at that point, I'm going to cut you off and you'll be left for the beasts of the field. That's Malbim in a nutshell. I hope just by repeating the same things multiple times it's actually going to work. I'm not sure that actually works. It doesn't work as a parenting technique. But it's just the way I learned it. Meaning I learned this by reading and rereading and rereading, and I'm trying to do that in a much shorter period of time. Then you have Ibn Ezra. And Ibn Ezra has a lot of the same components as Malbim does, except that the first part is not about them saying to everybody, you should capitulate and give in. The first part of it is simply a statement of you send your boats across these waters. Now send your agents to the Jews and let them know Sennacherib was defeated. Jerusalem stands. And at that point, I'm actually going to cut off the enemy. And as you said, these are predictions for the near future. Then Radak...
You had mentioned Koresh and all that, but that doesn't seem to...
No. Cyrus doesn't fit into this historically. I just find it interesting, this prediction of the nations sending the Jews home, because that was what Cyrus ended up doing.
Right.
But you're right, not at this point in history at all. The Babylonians still have to come through.
The Jews came back from Ethiopia.
Yeah, Persia's not Ethiopia.
They came from all over.
Correct.
They came from...
Well, except that he says throughout his empire they should come home. Not just the capital city of Babel, but throughout the empire.
But I forgot. I thought
yeah.
It was...
He says throughout his empire they should all be sent. They don't all go.
They don't all post it.
But we did say, yeah, remember we had the census and we were troubled because the numbers didn't add up to 42,000? And what we said was there were some from Babel and those are the ones who get listed, and then there were others who did not get listed. Yeah. So then within these views, this Mimushach Umorat, this nation either is a nation that is glorious, they have an extended empire, and they're very flashy, right? That was Malbim's read. Or it's the Jews who are plucked and dragged around, and that was Ibn Ezra and Radak. The images lend themselves to be read either way, and that's part of what makes this so hard. And then we get Abarbanel. And Abarbanel is just glorious. He's in his element. Abarbanel loves these sorts of visions. Take a look at number 7, please, because I brought you an extended piece of Abarbanel. He says, I'm going to translate it going along. I'm not going to read the Hebrew aloud. I'm just going to do translation. This entire portion, he says, is not stated about Gog and Magog. Okay? It's not about them. And the messengers who are going to be sent from the land of these wings, to know whether the Jews have returned to their land in order to go fight with them, is not what's going on. Rather, the goal is to seek their love and to accept God. Now, I should note, because I just noticed it on the sheet, these are Shemos. The sheets have Hashem's name on them. I'm usually pretty good about it, but the second line in Abarbanel has God's name. If you want to give me the sheet afterwards to put in Geniza, I can. If you want to keep it and just treat it respectfully, that's fine as well. If there are spare sheets around, though, and people can pass them to me, that would be great. I apologize. I'm usually pretty good, but the word Elokut there is divinity.
Could you explain what you just said about the gold? Who's loving who?
Right, so he's saying, what Abarbanel is saying is the following. There are those who have said that what's going on is messengers wanting to send the message, the Jews have returned to their land and it's time to fight them. What happens is that Barbanel, before this point in his commentary, brings you other commentaries. He brings you, actually in the beginning here, Christian commentary to this. Two different versions of this story as found among the Christians. Then he brings you the classic Jewish approach, which basically is Radak. And then he says they're all wrong and here's what it is. That's what he does. So so he says, it's not sending messengers to fight with the Jews, to go tell the world the Jews have returned, time to go fight. No, it's telling them, go tell the world the Jews have returned, and therefore it's time to accept Hashem as God. A vision that Yeshaya saw, you saw back in chapter 2, and that will appear in Yeshaya towards the end of the book. And he says, I think, this is the best part, he says, I think, we're in the second paragraph, that Ethiopia and those lands that are beyond the rivers of Ethiopia were all under the reign of Sennacherib and the Assyrians. And they were at the edges of civilization to the north. I don't know what he means by to the north. I've tried to figure it out. I don't know what he means. North Africa. I don't know what he's talking about. But he says, because we mentioned in the previous chapter the fall of Sennacherib and all of his nations, those who died wondrously when they attacked Jerusalem, therefore it now mentions the land of these wings in order to broadcast the miracle of the fall of Sennacherib. I'm sorry. In order to say, these lands all know about the fall of Sennacherib. This is what I had said before, that they all tell their children about the fall of Sennacherib. And now they're going to remember that when they hear this news in the future, about what has happened in the future. When they hear about Mashiach, they're going to think, oh, that's like what happened to Sennacherib, because these are lands where Sennacherib once was the king. And he says, Vihine. Behold, he says, if you can read the Hebrew, it's worthwhile, in the third paragraph. He called this land Silsal Kenafayim. What does that mean? Bavurov Hatsel Asher, because it has a lot of shade. Because it has a lot of large trees that grow next to the rivers, the way that today the Portuguese testify when they travel those rivers. Remember, Barbanel is writing at the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century, the great age of exploration. So he says, the Portuguese explorers have come back and told us about rivers with great trees overshadowing them. And he says, that's what this vision is about. And they say that these trees reach all the way up to the heavens and they cast great shade. And he says, the boats of the Christians travel these rivers underneath the shadows that are all across the rivers. He means the Christian explorers, the missionaries who are traveling through these regions. And he says, go swift messengers, we're now in the fourth paragraph, meaning they should go swiftly to the Jews, the nation that was until now memushach umorat, dragged along, plucked. And he says, this is the nation that was kav, not lines, but tikva, the nation that had great hope throughout, even though they were mevusa, they had been despoiled. So the messengers should now go bring them home. And not only that, but kol yoshvei tevel, in the fifth paragraph, all who dwell on earth, all who dwell in the land, not only those beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, but throughout the land. When God will raise his banner and they hear the sound of the shofar, they will hear and they will see. And he says, it doesn't mean literally a shofar. Don't think there's literally a shofar blown in the time of Mashiach and that's the way it's going to work. He says, that can't be. You can't raise up a banner that everybody sees. You can't blow a shofar that everybody hears. He didn't know about the internet. So instead, what it means is, either when the Jews return, that will be like the sounding of a shofar for the world, a banner for the world, or he says, there's going to be a wondrous miracle of Tchiyat HaMetim, the ultimate resurrection of the dead. And now he throws in something that you never see coming. He throws in this other piece to all of this, which is, God says, I will be silent and look at my foundation, not the way everybody else took it. God saying, I, God, am going to rest when I see Jerusalem, and that's when I'm going to put a halt to everything. No, God said to me that I, Yeshaya, will rest. I will look at my foundation, meaning he's predicting his own death. He says, God said to me that I will be laid to rest, and I am going to look upon my body, I'm going to look upon the body where my soul rested, and then ultimately I will rise at the time of Triyat HaMeitim, at the time of the restoration of the dead to life, when there will be like the warmth of the sun, and so forth. Yes?
That's what Hashem said to Daniel as well at the end.
That he will come back also. But Hamodoro, correct. Same idea in that sense. One other note that I wanted to make sure to mention. In all of this, you've heard of the Sambation River?
No.
Yes. What is the Sambation River, for those who have heard of it? That's a good question. The Sambation River is supposed to be the river beyond which the 10 tribes are located. That they have not yet come home. They're located behind this river, and there are stories about it Talmudically, about how it's active and it throws up stones all week long, but on Shabbos it stops. And the idea of the Jews being behind this river and of the river being in Africa has a couple of sources that support it in Tanakh, but this is one of the sources. The idea that those 10 tribes are lost in Ethiopia, and now of course you think about the Ethiopian stories about coming from the 10 tribes and so on, all of that comes from here.
What he said taken.
What do you mean?
To me, it sounds very far-fetched. I'm wondering what...
Abarbanel?
Yes. I wonder what other people of his time, when he came out with this...
Right.
Sort of said, has he gone over the
teeth? No. Yeah, Abarbanel was very broadly accepted. I mean, I don't know about everybody. I haven't done research on that. But Abarbanel, remember, is speaking to a Jewish population that is very open to this. This is a time of great messianism among the Jews because they're suffering the expulsion. No, he's not for much later. Usher Lamaline is this time. Then Solomon Mocho a little bit later. This is a time when, number one, the greater world is in a lot of ferment. This is the beginning right before the Reformation. This is when they've done these great discoveries of, you know, the whole Western Hemisphere. This is the Renaissance has changed things. The printing press at the end of the 15th century. A ton of upheaval going on. I feel like we just discussed this last Wednesday in the class of Bethema. About Luther. This is a time when there's great upheaval and the Jews are suffering so. And they're very open to the idea. This is the suffering that precedes Mashiach. And so there's a lot of acceptance of what he's saying. And that's what he... Yeah, absolutely. All right, there's so much more to say about this, but hopefully this gave us something to work with in terms of chapter 18. I apologize that it's confusing, but I figured this was the best way to try to capture a little bit of what's going on. Debbie?
So when you do us a favor on Tuesday, just start out with the summary of this.
Oh, yeah.
It's all going to be like
I generally tend to.
Yeah.
To start out with a summary, yeah. But chapter 19 is going to take us in an entirely different direction. So if you didn't like 18, that's okay. 19 is going to be that Egypt. But we are coming back to the Ethiopians. You should definitely read ahead. Like I said in the beginning of the year, please read ahead if you can find the time. It will definitely help.
But it doesn't help.
Thank you. No, I disagree. If someone reads this, I mean, I don't know. You read it. But you tell me. It didn't help you at all.